Chapter 4, Part 2 of The Assault on Mount Everest, 1922. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Avai in May 2022. The Assault on Mount Everest, 1922, by various authors. Chapter 4, The Problem, by George Mallory. Part 2. We had ascended not more than 1,000 feet next morning when one of the party decided that he was too ill to go on. He exhibited the usual symptoms of mountain sickness. While the other two suffered the disappointment of turning back, Somerville and I pushed on towards a snow col on the north ridge of the mountain. As it was desirable to reach this point without delay, in order to see the view while it was yet unclouded, and to take photographs, I continued at my own pace, and eventually found myself looking down on Somerville some distance below me as he struggled up with frequent halts. I very soon made up my mind that we should get no higher than this. But after a brief halt and some refreshment, when he had rejoined me, Somerville announced that he was prepared to go on. We began to make our way along a rock ridge, which became ever steeper as we mounted. Our progress was slow indeed, and I kept thinking, as I found myself more and more fatigued, "Surely we must give up now. A man in his state can't go on climbing such rocks as these." But whenever I asked how he was feeling, he would answer that he was getting along well enough, and as we gradually won our way up, and I kept my eye on my watch, I began to see that we had really a chance of reaching the summit. The rocks were by no means easy, and it is commonly said that the effort of climbing difficult rocks is just what will prove most exhausting, if it can be undertaken at all, to men affected by altitude. The struggle to overcome a steep obstacle must always interfere with regular breathing. Nevertheless, I am inclined to think that the advantage in sheer acceleration of climbing difficult rocks compensates the greater trouble in breathing, and that so long as I am still in a state to climb them, I prefer even difficult rocks to snow. The actual exertion put forth in mounting even the steepest cliff is often overrated. If there are moments of intense struggle, these are rare, and though the demand on nervous concentration is great, the climber proceeds for the most part with balanced movements, requiring, indeed, the sureness of trained muscles, but no tremendous output of strength. With such balanced movement, the two of us were able to go slowly upwards, without a rapidly increasing exhaustion, to the foot of a formidable gendarme. We had hopes in the first instance that he might be compelled to yield to a frontal attack. But 30 feet up, we found our way barred by a slab, which was at once so smooth and so exposed that, though we felt it might conceivably be climbed, we decided it was not for us to climb it at the present moment. Our allowance of rope was insufficient for operations which might require an abseil on the descent. We therefore turned to the west side of our ridge. Here, of course, we were out of the sun, and the rocks were so cold that they felt sticky to the skin and blistered our fingertips. However, we managed to execute a sensational traverse, and afterwards climbed a steep wall, which brought us out above the slab from which we had turned back. It was here that we experienced both the difficulty and the danger of rock climbing at high altitudes. It was necessary, in a terribly exposed position, to pull oneself over an edge of rock onto a little platform. A big effort was required, but the reserve of strength had been exhausted. Having committed myself to this taxing struggling, the grim thought arose in my mind that at the critical moment I might be found wanting, and my body refuse to respond when the greatest effort was required of it. A great effort was required before I arrived panting on the airy stance. After these exciting moments, we reached the top of the gendarme without much trouble. but he had cost us too much time. We had to start from Yangkar this same day in pursuit of General Bruce, and ought to cross the quicksands of the Shiling Plain before dark. We had already overstepped the time allowed for the ascent according to our intention. The summit now appeared perhaps 500 feet above us, and the intervening rocks were evidently going to provide some stiff passages. It was necessary, therefore, to turn back here, and waste no time on the descent. The descent proved longer than we had expected. We chose a long traverse over steep snow to avoid the gendarme, and neither of us was in a condition to cut steps quickly. We observed, in fact, what I had observed last year with Bullock, that one may go down a considerable distance at a high altitude, and instead of recovering very quickly, as may happen in the Alps, one only becomes progressively more fatigued. It was 4:30 p.m. when we reached Giankar and found ourselves happily recovered from our exertions. Sankari was still unclimbed. But we looked back on our expedition with some satisfaction. We had been little short of 20,000 feet when we turned back, and I had been greatly impressed by Sommervell's endurance. For though very much fatigued before reaching the col at the foot of our ridge, and further enervated by an attack of dysentery which had begun on the previous day, his condition seemed rather to improve than to deteriorate above that point. For my part, I had come near enough to exhaustion, considering the difficulties of the climb, and had suffered from a severe headache, but certainly felt no worse than I expected at this stage of our training. I entered upon this tale with the object of illustrating the course of acclimatization among us, but the return to Giankar was not for us the end of the story. It was now clear that we could not hope to cross the quicksands before night. However, we might hope to reach the ford by which we must cross the river Yaru with still enough light to recognize the spot, and thereafter we could rest in a sheltered place I knew of until the late rising moon should show us the tracks of the main body. We set off accordingly in high haste on the ponies we found waiting for us. Our instruction had been that these animals should be specially selected for their fleetness of foot, for Tibetan ponies can, some of them, travel at a fair speed, while others no amount of flogging will urge beyond 3 miles an hour. The beast I rode very quickly showed that he was one of these last. I had entrusted my ice axe to a porter who accompanied us, and now told him to ride behind me and use it if necessary. For 5 miles he used it with a dexterity and energy beyond praise. Then I abandoned the pony, and, walking ahead of the party, easily outstripped the rest encumbered with this beast. Night fell when we were still 2 miles short of the ford. But as Sommervell and I approached the spot and wondered exactly where it might be, we perceived lights a little way ahead on the further bank of the river, presumably those of a Tibetan camp, and soon a figure appeared on that side. We were hailed in Tibetan. Our Sirdar, coming up, spoke Tibetan in reply. The figure waded across to us, and it was explained to me that this good Samaritan was prepared to carry me over on his back. I readily agreed to so generous a proposition. He was not an easy steed, but I was able to hang on to him for 100 yards or so until he deposited me on the other bank, a light enough burden, apparently, to be picked up and set down like a child. And 400 yards further we reached the lights. It was no stranger camp. The tents were ours, and the general and the rest were sitting in the mess while dinner was keeping hot in the kitchen against our return. 10 days later we reached our base camp at the foot of the Rongbuk Glacier, 16,800 feet, and contemplated the prospect of rising another 12,000 feet and more to the summit of Mount Everest. At all events, the whole party had reached this point remarkably fit, and no one now showed signs of distress from staying at this elevation. Remembering how Bullock and I had felt after our first exertions up here last year, I hope to spend a few days at the base camp before doing very much, and as General Bruce's plans worked out, nothing was required of me at present. But much was asked of the reconnaissance party which started out on May 4. It has been recorded in earlier chapters how in 3 days from the base camp they reached a height of 21,500 feet on the East Rongbuk Glacier. The cold was great, and their hardships were unrelieved by the greater comfort of established camps enjoyed by those who followed the pioneers. From their accounts, they were evidently affected a good deal by altitude before turning back with their work accomplished, and in spite of the cold, they experienced a familiar phenomenon of lassitude so painfully and particularly noticeable on the glaciers when the sun makes itself felt. But on the whole, they had been less affected by the want of air than was to be expected. They had this advantage, and they proceeded gradually. The distance to travel was long, but the ascent was never steep, and they found the upper glacier very lightly covered with snow, and it is heavy going and a steep ascent that most readily induced the more distressing symptoms of mountain sickness. However, from the point of view of acclimatization, it was highly satisfactory that this party should have proceeded with so little delay to reach 21,000 feet. Meanwhile, Somerville and I, chafing somewhat at our inactivity and with the idea that a long day on the mountains would do us good at this stage, on May 6 climbed a small peak above the left bank of the Rongbuk Glacier. It was a day of small misfortunes for me. As we were walking on the stony slopes in the early morning, my trichonie nails of hard steel slipped on a granite slab, and I contrived to leave there an incredible amount of skin from the back of my right hand. And higher, as we worked along a broken ridge, a large boulder poised in unstable equilibrium slipped as I brushed it with my knee and fell on the big toe joint so as to pinion my right foot. It was an awkward moment, for the place was steep. I just had strength to heave it over and down the mountainside, and luckily no bones were broken. But walking was very painful afterwards, and perhaps this accident had something to do with the fatigue I felt as we neared the summit. On the lower slopes I had been going well enough and seemed fitter than Somerville. At 21,000 feet he was apparently no more fatigued than at 18,000 or 19,000 feet, while I could scarcely drag one leg after the other. And when we came back to camp, I was surprisingly glad to take a little whisky in my tea. 3. I have said too much already about the early stage of acclimatization. My excuse must be that much will depend upon this factor. The issue will depend no less on organization and transport, and though this subject is General Bruce's province, at all events, so far as Camp 3, I have a few words to add to what he has written. In the calculation of what will be required at various stages in order to reach the summit of Mount Everest, it is necessary to begin at the highest, and the climber imagines in the first place where he would like to have his camps. He may imagine that on the final day he might rise 2,000 feet to the summit. If he is to give himself the best chance of success, he will not wish to start much lower than 27,000 feet, and in any case he cannot camp much higher, for he is very unlikely to find a place on the ridge above the northeast shoulder, 27,400 feet, or on the steep rocks within 200 feet of it. We may therefore fix 27,000 feet approximately as the desirable height for the last camp. And we have another camping ground fixed for us by circumstances, approximately at 23,000 feet, the broad shelf lying in the shelter of the ice cliffs on the North Col. There is no convenient place for a comparatively large camp for a considerable distance either above or below it. But to carry up a camp 4,000 feet at these altitudes would be to ask altogether too much of the porters. We must therefore establish an intermediary camp between these two, say at 25,000 feet, if a place can be found. Now, What will be required at these three camps? We must ask first with what number of climbers the assault is to be made. A party of two appears insufficient, for if one man should become exhausted, the other will probably want help in bringing him down. This difficulty is met by having three climbers. But since an exhausted man cannot be left alone, certainly not without the shelter of a tent, nor should one man go on alone, a party of three must turn back so soon as one man is unable to go further. Four men would give a better chance of success in this case, for then two might go on, and still leave one to look after the sick man. Granted, then, that the best hope is for four men to start from a camp at 27,000 feet, we have firstly to provide them with tents. Two tents are better than one, for it may be difficult to find a place of four men to lie side by side, and the greater weight of two smaller tents above one larger is inconsiderable. And they must have sleeping bags, provisions for 2 days, fuel, and cooking pots. All these necessities have been previously carried up to the camp below at 25,000 feet, but other things besides are required there. We may assume that this camp is to be used as a stage on the way up only, and not on the way down. Even so, six porters at least will have to sleep there before carrying up the highest camp, and their requirements will be the same as we have laid down for the four climbers. We must add another day's provisions and fuel for the climbers themselves. It will be understood from this method of calculation how we arrive at the number of loads which must be carried up to any given camp. It is observable that at each stage downwards the number increases in a proportion considerably greater than 2 to 1. Fortunately, we are not obliged to proceed strictly on these lines. To the lower camps we need not carry up the whole of our stores on one day, and consequently we need not increase in this alarming ratio the number of our porters. But in any case, when we get down to the North Col, we must clearly have a large bulk of stores, and the fewer porters we employ between one stage and another, economizing on tents and sleeping bags, the more time we shall require. It was clear from the start that time was likely to be a formidable enemy. General Bruce's problem was not only to move our vast quantity of stores across an almost barren country, but to move them in a given time. It was fortunate for this reason that the number of porters who came with us was not increased, for every man must add something to our burdens. No one who knows that arid country could fail to be surprised that we reached our base camp below the Rongbuk Glacier so early as the 1st of May. But now the number of Nepalese porters, only 40 were available for carrying, was too small for all our needs. If they alone were to shoulder all our loads, when should we reach the North Col? Some sort of depot must be established below it at 21,000 feet for the supply of all higher camps on the mountain before we could proceed, and the reconnaissance party determined that two staging camps would be required between the base camp and this depot. The existence and the solution of so large a problem of transport have so important a bearing on our later plans that I must refer to it again in this place. General Bruce has told how he impressed Tibetans into his service, and by using them up to Camp 2 was able to liberate our own porters much earlier than might have been expected for work further on. But the system of employing Tibetans did not work without a hitch. It was because the 1st Labour Battalion absconded that General Bruce gave orders for only two of us to go forward and use the first opportunities for pushing on from Camp 3. With the prospect of an early monsoon and a shortage of transport, it was desirable that, so soon as any porters were available for work above Camp 3, this work should be pushed on without delay, and if necessary, an assault should be made with the minimum of stores required by a party of two climbers. Without a further supply of transport, there was no question of using the oxygen, for we should have more than enough to carry up without it. On May 10, Somerville and I started from the base camp for Camp 1. the way already customary among the porters, led us at first over the flat waste of stones, intersected occasionally by dry stream beds, which lies below the black, humpy snout of the Rongbuk Glacier. We then followed the deep trough below the glacier's right, west bank, an obvious line, but rough with great boulders. It is not before reaching the head of this trough, where one must turn up towards the East Rongbuk Glacier, that a problem arises as to how best to proceed. Here we found that an adequate path had already been stamped on the loose moraine, and after ascending steeply, we contoured the hillside at an easy gradient. A little forethought and energy had devised so good a way that we could walk comfortably from one camp to the other in 2 hours and a half. Moreover, we were highly pleased by Camp 1. The draught perpetually blowing down the main glacier was scarcely noticed in this side valley. The afternoon sun was shining to cheer the stony scene, and away to the west some noble peaks were well placed for our delight. But beyond aesthetic satisfaction, we were soon aware of a civilized habitation. We had been in camp only a few minutes when a cook brought us tea and sweet biscuits and demanded to know what we would like for dinner. We ordered a good dinner and proceeded to examine our apartments. Geoffrey Bruce, we knew, had been busy here with certain constructional works to obviate the difficulty of carrying up heavy tents, which were required in any case at the base camp. We found a little house reserved for Europeans, one of four solidly built with stones and roofed, with the outer flies of whimper tents. I never measured up this chamber. I suppose the floor must have been 8 feet by 10 feet, and the roof 4 feet high. It is true the tent poles bridging across from side to side in support of the roof were in dangerously unstable equilibrium, and there were windy moments when valetudinously minded persons might have pronounced it a draughty room. But we were far from hypercritical on this first night, particularly as no wind blew, and a wonderful and pleasant change it was, after living in tents, to sit, eat, and sleep in a house once more. The greater part of our Alpine stores, with which I was especially concerned, had already reached Camp 1, and there I found the various bundles of tents, ropes, sleeping bags, crampons, paraffin, petrol, primus stoves, cooking sets, etc., which I had carefully labelled for their respective destinations. The great majority were labelled for three. No higher destination had yet been assigned, and I speculated, not altogether optimistically, as to the probable rates of their arrival. As the general order of transport was interrupted for the present, we had to decide what we should take on with us, both of food and Alpine stores. Somerville, who by now was an expert in the numbers and contents of food boxes, vigorously selected all that we preferred, and we went to bed with very good hopes for the future, at least in one respect. In consequence of these puzzling problems, it took us some little time in the morning to make up our loads. It was past 10 o'clock when we started on our way to Camp 2. I was surprised, after we had proceeded some distance along the stones on the left bank of the East Rongbuk Glacier, to observe a conspicuous cairn, evidently intended to mark our way over the glacier itself. But the glacier in its lower end is so completely covered with stones that in choosing the easiest way one is only concerned to find the flattest surfaces, and as we mildly followed where the route had been laid out by Colonel Strutt and his party, we found the glacier far less broken than was to be expected. Ultimately, we walked along a conspicuous medial moraine, avoiding by that means some complicated ice, and descended it abruptly to find ourselves on the flat space where Camp 2 was situated. By this time we had seen a good deal of the East Rongbuk Glacier. As we came up the moraine near its left bank, we looked northwards on a remarkable scene. From the stony surface of the glacier fantastic pinnacles arose, a strange, gigantic company, gleaming white as they stood in some sort of order, divided by the definite lines of the moraines. Beyond and above them was a vast mountain of reddish rock, known to us only by the triangulated height of its sharp summit, marked in Wheeler's map as 23,180. The pinnacles became more thickly crowded together as we mounted, until, as we followed the bend southwards, individuals were lost in the crowd, and finally the crowd was merged in the great tumbled sea of the glacier, now no longer dark with stones, but exhibiting everywhere the bright surfaces of its steep and angry waves. At Camp 2 we were surrounded on three sides by this amazing world of ice. We lay in the shelter of a vertical cliff not less than 60 feet high, somberly cold in the evening shadow, dazzlingly white in the morning sun, and perfectly set off by the frozen pool at its foot. Nothing, of course, was to be seen of Mount Everest. The whole bulk of the North Peak stood in front of it. But by mounting a few steps up some stony slopes above us, we could see to the southeast, over the surface of the ice, the slopes coming down from the Lapka La, from which high pass we had looked down the East Rongbuk Glacier in September 1921, and observed the special whiteness of the broken stream, at our own level now, and puzzled over its curious course. We had yet another sight to cheer us as we lay in our tents. On the range between us and the main Rongbuk Glacier stood, in the one direction of uninterrupted vision, a peak of slender beauty, and as the moon rose, its crests were silver cords. Next morning, May 12, according to Colonel Strutt's directions, we worked our way along the true left edge of the glacier and the stones of its left bank. The problem here is to avoid that tumbled sea of ice where no moraine can be continuously followed. Probably it would be possible to get through this ice almost anywhere, for it is not an ice fall. The gradient is not steep, the pinnacles are not seracs, and there are few crevasses, but much time and labour would be wasted in attempting such a course. Further up, the surface becomes more even, and the reconnaissance party had reached this better surface by only a short and simple crossing of the rougher ice. We easily found the place, marked by a conspicuous cairn, where they had turned away from the bank. Their tracks on the glacier, though snow was lying in the hollows, were not easy to follow, and we quickly lost them. But presently we found another cairn built upon a single large stone, and here proceeded with confidence to cross a deep and wide trough of which we had been warned. And once this obstacle was overcome, we knew no difficulty could impede our progress to Camp 3. The laden porters, however, did not get along very easily. Their nails, for the most part, were worn smooth, and they found the ice too slippery. As I had never seen in the Alps a glacier surface like this one, I was greatly surprised by the nature of the bare ice. In a sense, it was often extremely rough, with holes and minute watercourses having vertical sides 6 inches to 13 inches high, but the upper surfaces of the little knobs and plateaus intervening were extraordinarily hard and smooth, and the colour was very much bluer than the usual granular surface of a dry glacier. It was also surprising to find at most a thin coating of fine snow as high as 20,500 feet, for in 1921 we had found, even before the first heavy snowfall, plenty of snow on the glaciers above 19,000 feet. For my part, with new nails in my boots, I was not troubled by the slippery surfaces, but we decided to supply the porters with crampons, which they subsequently found very useful on this stage of the journey. End of chapter 4, part 2.